El acero en tu monedero es el placebo que nos repara. Gobiernos que disparan con un clic. Espécimen viviendo el infierno del régimen de Wall Street. Te inoculan el...
We're back in the studio, Relatos Zapatistas, broadcasting live from West Oakland on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM. Streaming live on berkeleyliberationradio.net. You can call us in the studio at 510-495-1666 or shoot us an email at relatos zapatistas, both those words are plural, at gmail.com. All our shows are up on indiebay.org after the fact, and also on the website of our compañeros at radiozapatista.org, so you can find everything that we have always produced, and the show will be up there as well. So last Friday, on June 3rd, an anti-austerity action took place in downtown Oakland that consisted of a march and a film screening, a guerrilla film screening in an empty lot. And during the action, the following flyer was distributed. It's titled, "Take the Streets, a Message to Occupied Oakland in a Time of Cuts and Crisis." Now that the banks have been bailed out and the rich treated to yet another tax cut, our libraries and schools, already devastated, are once again on the chopping block, while our elderly and poor are turned out on the streets. Heavily armed cops with increased powers roam our city's streets, threatening anyone who steps out of line. Times have never been better, in other words, for the rich. It's not as if things weren't already pretty bad. Each one of us is a casualty of the economy in one way or another. Jobs that pay next to nothing or no jobs at all, rent that keeps increasing, gas prices that double overnight, student loans we'll never be able to pay back. But what's most distressing of all is how little we're able to do about this, how little control we seem to have over these things. Perhaps, though, our lack of control is not so complete. On nights like this, with all of us in the street together, we remember that when people number in the hundreds and the thousands, they can do nearly anything. Laws, it seems, apply to individuals, not crowds. In Oakland, of course, the legacy of the Black Panthers remains inescapable. The Panthers, we remember, were not merely indignant. They did something about it. They organized themselves. They did not simply petition the ruling powers for more resources, but took what they needed as necessary. And what the state couldn't provide, they would. This is the meaning of their free breakfast programs for school children, their free clothing programs, their libraries and crossing guards. So we understand that the decision makers will never give us what we want because it's not something they can give. And although the street is merely a small portion of what we must reclaim, it's a crucial start. Without this public space for us to meet each other and to organize outside our homes and jobs, nothing could ever begin to happen. So tonight, we're in the streets in resistance. We will be here until we are no longer needed. And joining us in the studio right now is our compañero Ilya, who's going to be talking to us a little bit about the action. So the first question we want to ask you is just sort of tell us a little bit more in detail about what happened during the action and sort of how you thought it went.
Thanks for having me. So we started off with the march met at Telegraph and Broadway, the intersection of those two streets, which we like just because it's a really nice location. Some of you will know that there's a little triangular square right there, and it opens on to about six different streets. So there's numerous ways to leave that triangle, which is advantageous because, you know, if the police decided that they wanted to keep us there for one reason or another, we'd be able to find a way out. It's also the place where the 1946 Oakland General Strike started, and so we like that significance. So we started there, and we marched up Telegraph toward Art Murmur with a sound system playing electronic music and hip-hop, and people were carrying banners, and we made our way up to Art Murmur, and once we got to the corner of 23rd and Telegraph, we stopped for a little bit and distributed propaganda to the people who were at Art Murmur. And I think what we were trying to do was to take a slightly confrontational stance toward the institution of Art Murmur, but also attempt to maybe radicalize some of the people who could be radicalized and could be won over to our side. And then once we had done that, we moved on. We moved up Telegraph north to 25th and took a right on Telegraph and then went down by some of the galleries there. We stopped in front of the galleries for a little bit. There's a slight confrontation with a local gallerist. And then we moved on from there. We went to the parking lot that we'd picked out to screen some video clips. And we watched those for about an hour and a half, and then we called it a night.
So, and you thought it was a successful event?
I thought it was really successful. I think our goal here was to start small and to think long term, or at least medium term. We're trying to sort of build something that we sort of conceive of this as a project that will take place over the course of the summer, and we want to keep doing these things and slowly build. So, and there were about 100 people out there, which we think is pretty good for a first action, and we want to just keep bringing people out, and we want to, you know, find a way to have fun, get our message out there, and become slowly more confrontational as the summer goes on. But I think the most important thing is that we sort of learn how to act together, develop certain forms of coordination and discipline that we're going to need, and be patient.
So the action was defined as an anti-austerity action, and the idea was sort of to build capacity for response to austerity measures at the state and city government. And so I wonder if we could take a step back, and maybe you could talk a little bit about what austerity means to you beyond budget cuts, and maybe define austerity in terms of what the action was targeting specifically.
Right. Okay. I think in, at the most practical level, austerity does mean budget cuts. I mean, that's really what we're dealing with here in the immediate case, is that all kinds of services and programs are on the chopping block, and the money that is available for those things is being diminished. You know, from schools to libraries to mental health programs to food assistance programs, housing, etc. Everything basically that you might kind of like about the state is being cut, you know, whereas everything that you dislike about the state, like, you know, these thugs with guns that walk around, they're getting plenty of money, or prisons. So I think that's what it means, but I think in a larger sense, it just means a kind of form of rationing or belt tightening. And the term really, from what I can tell, came into use during World War II in Britain with their sort of wartime economic policy, as they were setting in place these measures of social rationing to keep people from consuming too much with things that they needed for the war effort or for the army. So really it's about applying an almost military discipline to the entirety of a society. And I think that's what's happening here. But I also don't think that we should see it as something that is being taken away. They're only taken away. That's to say, a lot of money is being removed from programs, but at the same time there are all kinds of measures of things that are being given and increasing powers and forces that are being brought to bear on our lives. So maybe funding for schools is being withdrawn, but at the same time, there are all these kinds of programs for making sure that there's ample amounts of credit for banks and for consumers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that has to do with, well, there's another question, you know, which is why go to Art Murmur? And one of the banners that was carried during the march said, "Austerity loves gentrification." And I think, I mean, obviously one of the ways to think about Art Murmur has to do with gentrification. Apparently there are some internal struggles within the art community in Oakland that are split over this stuff. And thinking about the way that austerity sucks money out of some areas and inserts it back into other areas. So maybe you could talk a little bit more about why Art Murmur in particular was targeted during this action, and sort of more generally the relationship between austerity and gentrification.
Sure. Well, I think that you know, what you see in Oakland is an incredibly impoverished city, one that's built on a history of profound racism and also profound self-organization on the part of minorities, particularly African Americans in Oakland. But then, you know, you have this kind of process of what we would call gentrification, that's to say sort of middle class white people moving into the area, you know, for reasons that are understandable. It's a good place to live, it's cheap, and you know, there's a kind of obliviousness to the effect of that on other people. And there's, you know, this process is encouraged by the institutions of the city, the various business councils that negotiate and make life easier for these small businesses in order to steer the city in a certain direction. So I think that you have to see this as part of one process.
Another example of a place where money is being taken out of is the Oakland libraries, which are on the Chapman block. There's a proposal out there, you know, to cut 14 out of 18 libraries in Oakland, public libraries, and the Oakland librarians are calling for people to come out and support them in their struggle. And there was a city council meeting a couple weeks ago that I remember going to, where they were supposedly going to be talking about cutting these libraries. And when we went into the meeting, it just happened that when we went in there, the police chief was talking about how the budget cuts were going to affect them, like the Oakland Police Department. It was very clear that they basically weren't going to be hit with any cuts at all. The only difference between the different budget cut scenarios was sort of how much of an increase they were going to get. And the police chief was talking specifically about how he was very worried that they wouldn't be able to fly their helicopter as much as he wanted to fly it, or something like that. So I think it's important to talk about the police as an endpoint of these revenues that are sucked out of other areas, but also maybe you could talk a little bit more about the sort of the relationship between police and austerity, or the police as the enforcers of austerity politics.
Absolutely. I think that you said it, that these measures are highly unpopular. They place people in extreme predicaments, and you're going to find people resisting them in all kinds of ways. And as unemployment and poverty increases, people are going to have to meet their needs in any way that they can. And the police are going to be there to make sure that the private property in the city is protected. And so, they're really the occupying army of an austerity regime. And it makes sense that the city government would want to continue funding them as much as possible. It's interesting that right now, all across the country and in Oakland as well, crime statistics are really falling for reasons that nobody seems to really understand. Some people think it has to do with cell phone cameras and the ubiquitousness of our ability to surveil each other, right, and take pictures of each other at any moment. But for one reason or another, there has been less crime, and however defined, this year than in past years. So there's even less reason to fund police now. I don't think there's much reason to fund them in any case, but certainly they don't have a lot of ground to stand on in asking for continued. I mean, I think in Oakland, the police budget is something like 60% of the entire city budget. It's massive. So
and they got like federal funding last year, right?
They got bailed out right after the economic crisis by some kind of federal granting program.
So there's one more sort of abstract question to think about. I think the reason we were curious to talk earlier about defining austerity is that when you approach austerity as just budget cuts, it sort of channels all anti-austerity politics into a model that's really focused on not cutting the budget or sort of restoring the liberal welfare state. And so coming at it from an anarchist or anti-state or ultra-left position, how do you sort of articulate an anti-austerity politics that doesn't get funneled into or co-opted by a more like liberal politics of, you know, restore funding to these government or state institutions?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't know that I have the best answer to that question. It's something I think about a lot, and I think it's a real problem for us. And I do think that like it or not, unless we're able to sort of bring sufficient force, we probably are going to get channeled back in the direction of the welfare state. That's to say, even if you don't make a demand on the state to, restore some form of of public assistance, even if you, even if your own position is a position of sort of autonomy, unless you're able to overthrow the state, that's what you're going to get, right? You're going to get the state will answer you in a particular form. So, but I do think that there's a way in which this, the condition of austerity is designed to pit us against each other, because as we know, the tax burden is disproportionately distributed so that you know, working class and middle class people are paying for the government to conduct wars. And so there's a way in which, you know, it can pit the working class against the poor and in a really kind of ridiculous way. And I think that if you answer that and you say, we don't want the state in any way, we don't want the state as an austerity state, and we don't want it as a welfare state either. And if we recognize that, you know, even the welfare state, I think people have very kind of nostalgic, rosy views of what it was. It wasn't that great. It was based upon racism and exclusion. I mean, you can't have the kind of welfare state without Vietnam or the kind of late Jim Crow era legislation. So, I mean, I think that we have to be honest about what it was in the United States. At the same time, I simply do not think that there's any possibility of it returning. I see the conditions for capitalism right now is quite grim, and I don't think that the kind of profits that the corporations can draw right now will make them very amenable to paying for these kinds of programs, which they were amenable to in the 50s and 60s. They simply are not going to give an inch. And that means that even fighting for better schools becomes a nearly kind of revolutionary fight. And I think you saw that in places like, you know, I think you see this in places like Spain or in Greece, where these fights over kind of matters of legislation or policy take on an almost revolutionary intensity. I mean, in France last November, you had people burning down cities and blockading oil refineries over a change in a pension law, right? So there's a way in which these kind of small matters of policy right now, simply because the state and the ruling class is so obstinate, can really become really explosive. So. And I think that means that maybe these things can kind of, these contradictions can work themselves out.
So there's another action scheduled for 2 weeks from now for June 17th. So I guess, apparently it's not entirely clear what the action is going to consist of yet, but maybe you could talk a little bit more about what the sort of overall strategy is, like using the sort of tactics like film screenings, you know, and sort of taking the streets instead of just a boring rally. And maybe also say where people can find more information about what the next action will be, so people will be able to come out over the course of the summer as intensity is building.
Okay, sure. I think that what we're trying to do is we're trying to move the anarchist or the anti-state communist milieu away from maybe a kind of more reactive way of being and organize something that has a little bit more continuity. I think there's a tendency for us to wait for an existing social movement to arise and then insert ourselves into it and try to kind of radicalize it, right? And so I think there's a way in which people can end up taking on a kind of parasitic relationship to, and not in the sense of being outside the so-called outside agitators, but just simply not doing the organizing work originally to kind of get something started. And I think what we see in California is that, we're probably not going to see a kind of Wisconsin thing happen in California, which was, you know, an example of a mass anti-austerity movement arising, largely led by unions and the Democratic Party to a certain extent. And the reason why that won't happen here is we have a Democratic governor, and the unions won't do a single thing. They won't. I mean, they might kind of protest in really minor, ineffective forms, but it's just not going to happen. So, I think if we, you know, if we just sort of waited for somebody else to do it, if we waited for the kind of more social democratic or reformist left to start to kind of set the ball in motion, we're just going to wait forever. It's just not going to happen. So I think that we'll have to sort of build our own infrastructure. And that's, you know, that's hard. That's something that a lot of the people I know don't know how to do and aren't very good at. So I think that this is a way of trying to do that, and I think reframing our expectations and sort of setting our sights a little bit lower. I think people want to sort of come out in the streets, and they want it to be explosive and confrontational in a way that while that can be valuable, if you know what you have is just something happens every 6 months, and then everybody goes around and waits until the next kind of explosive thing happens, that's not going to kind of build the type of force that we want. So I think that where we're at is that you need to provide people with a reason to come out, and you need to make it fun, and you need to make it relevant, and you need to make it intelligent and exciting in a certain way. Nobody wants to go to a protest that is, I mean, certain people have a certain amount of stamina for really alienating, boring protests with boring slogans and chants. And some people can do that all their life long, and they can do it every day. You know, most people are just going to feel too depressed. So I think you have to try to make things fun, and that's what we're trying to do. And I think also people want to feel that they're being effective in some way. So we're going to try to kind of slowly ratchet up the level of confrontation and disruptiveness so that we can, you know, feel like we're beginning to have an effect. And we'll see where it goes.
So where can people find out about the next action?
You can go to bayofrage.com, which is a website. The next action is definitely going to be on the 17th, and it's definitely going to be in the afternoon. But we're not quite sure where we're meeting. It's probably going to be Broadway and Telegraph again, and we're not exactly sure about the start time. But you can find out more information on the website probably in a few days.
Well, thanks so much for sharing with us these thoughts about austerity and about this organizing body or non-organizing body that's organizing this stuff. And we're going to go to a short musical break, and then we'll be back with a short documentary about autonomous water politics in California.
There's nothing more refreshing than having a clear, crisp, clean glass of water on a warm summer's day.
That cool, refreshing drink.
Try it with your friends.